My name is Joy Severett, and I have the pleasure of introducing tonight's speaker, Dr. Joan Berzoff. Many of you are already somewhat familiar with her name because you are or you have read her most widely distributed book, Inside Out, Outside In. Even so, you may not be familiar with the range of her accomplishments and contributions to the school. Joan is a graduate of Washington University in St. Louis, where she received her BA degree. Her MSW comes from Smith College School for Social Work, and she received an EDD from Boston University. As a member of the resident faculty, Dr. Berzoff has provided leadership in the development of the human behavior and social environment sequence as chair for many years, as co-director of the doctoral program for 13 years, and she developed and coordinates one of the first end-of-life care programs for social work. Besides her administrative functions within the school, Joan is frequently on the road nationally and internationally, making presentations during meetings of various clinical societies, alumni associations of schools of social work, the American Association of Psychoanalysis and Clinical Social Work, and the Society for Social Work Research. Her scholarly work is quite extensive as well. She has published widely in journals such as Ophelia, the Journal of Palliative and Supportive Care, the Journal of Teaching and Social Work, and our own Smith College Studies in Social Work. Some of these journal articles have been written with current and former doctoral students. The list of book publications she has produced, besides Inside Out, Outside In, includes such titles as Dissociative Identity Disorders, Controversies in Diagnosis and Treatment, Living and Dying, A Handbook for End-of-Life Care Practitioners, and most recently, a new book currently in press entitled Falling Through the Cracks, Psychodynamic Practice with Vulnerable, At-Risk, and Oppressed Populations. She has received honors and awards as Outstanding Social Work Scholar from the National Academies of Practice, the Project on Death in American Leadership Award, and most recently from the Massachusetts chapter of NASW as the greatest contributions to social work education. When asked to introduce her, I reflected that the greatest contributions we make as scholars tend to flow from a personal experience that not only offers clarity, but also purpose. And I also reflected on the feminist view that the personal is political. Tonight's lecture on the transformative nature of grief and bereavement by Joan Berzoff, I believe, is both personal, but political and instructive. Would you join me in welcoming Joan Berzoff?
Thank you. What a lovely introduction. So, I want to begin tonight by talking about grief and bereavement from a psychodynamic perspective. And as I do so, I'm going to be maintaining that grief is not a pathological state, although it often feels that way. Then I want to consider the ways in which grief may, in fact, undo the mourner, resulting sometimes in complicated or in pathological grief. Next, I want to maintain that grief can be transformative, changing a mourner's sense of self, ideals, political and personal commitments, creating new meaning and new narratives that can live on as lasting legacies. And finally, I want to talk a little bit about the implications for practice. So let me begin with a poem by Christina Rossetti, which goes this way. Remember me when I am gone away, gone far into the silent land, where you can no longer hold me by the hand, nor I half turn to go, yet turning stay. Remember me when no more day by day you tell of our future planned. Only remember me, you understand, it will be too late then to counsel or to pray. Yet if you should forget me for a while, and afterwards remember me, do not grieve. For if the darkness and corruption leave a vestige of the thoughts that once I had, better by far that you should forget and smile than remember and be sad. So in this poem, I think Christina Rossetti is expressing the desire to be remembered not only with sadness, but with a smile. And indeed, we know that grief and bereavement are a very complex set of feelings that include anger, sadness, distress, but also joy, laughter, and humor. According to Webster, grief is largely negative. Quoting Webster's dictionary, grief is an intense emotional suffering caused by loss, misfortune, hardship, or pain. Yet tonight I want to maintain that grief, bereavement, and mourning are very multidimensional, depending upon the nature of the loss, the ways that loss is metabolized, the ways in which the loss may shape the self, the meanings that are created from any loss, the nature of relationships that continue with the dead, and the ways in which losses may actually positively transform the mourner. So while grief may leave us with longing and regret, grief also may leave the mourner, to use Lowell's words, sadder but wiser, creating new kinds of narratives that expand both self and identity in creative and unexpected ways. So let me begin with Freud. Can you all hear me? That's okay? Okay. Let me begin with Freud because he was the first psychological theorist to really think about how loss and grief change the mourner. Freud thought that grief was, again, not a pathological state, although, again, it often feels as if it is. He was interested, initially, in how loss and grief deplete us. They empty us out. In his view, he thought that mourning can feel like dejection, and it always feels like exhaustion. A part of this exhaustion, he thought, occurs because when a person dies, the mourner naturally withdraws his or her energy from the outside world while focusing on the nature of the loss. That is, the mourner is often preoccupied with the memories of the person who has died and is caught up between holding on to and letting go the object of the loss. Often, a mourner tries to hold on to the person who has died by telling the stories of the person over and over and over again, by looking at the photos that memorialize the person who has died, by writing poems or narratives or stories about the person who has died, wearing the clothes of the dead, playing the person's music, preparing her favorite foods, holding conversations with the dead, setting an extra place at the table, and ruminating about the terminal circumstances in which the death took place. Freud called this hypercathexis, and by this he was describing an intense energy with which we connect to a person who has died. But it seems that Ira Gershwin does a much better job of describing hypercathexis in the song that he wrote for his brother who died of a brain tumor. The way you wear your hat, the way you sip your tea, the memory of all that, you can't take that away from me. And here Gershwin is demonstrating how in mourning, each memory of the person who has died is full of meaning. Mourners keep the person alive by means of, again, the stories, the clothes, the music, also as a way of maintaining an ongoing relationship with that person. One way of thinking about this word, hypercathexis, comes from Joan Didion, who, in an effort to make sense of her husband's death from sudden cardiac arrest, mused about how she had hypercathected the memories that she had around the terminal circumstances of his death. She wrote, "Later, I realized that I must have repeated the details of what happened to everyone who came to the house in those first weeks, all the friends, all the relatives who brought food, made drinks, laid out the plates on the dining room table for however many people were around for lunch and dinner, all those who picked up the plates and froze the leftovers and ran the dishwasher and filled our otherwise empty apartment, even after I had gone to bed and shut the door. Those moments when I was abruptly overtaken by exhaustion are what I remember most clearly about the first days and weeks. I have no memory of telling anyone about the details, but I must have done so since everyone seemed to know them. At one point, I considered the possibility that perhaps they had picked up the details of the story from one another, but I immediately rejected it. The story they had was, in each instance, too accurate to have been passed from hand to hand. It had to have come from me. So what Joan Didion is describing is the ways in which she hyper-cathected the memories, again, around her husband's death, telling the stories of the terminal circumstances again and again and again, and in so doing, beginning to weave a narrative about his death. Freud wrote, "No one ever abandons a libidinal position," that means a loving position, "willingly, even when another beckons. Consequently, a mourner will not easily fall in love again." Again, grief takes immense energy. I'm going to show a little video clip that I think illustrates this perhaps better than words can. This is a clip from Madly, Truly, Deeply. A young woman is widowed. Her husband, with whom she was very close, has come back from the dead. And not only has he come back, but he has brought all of his ghost friends to move into her apartment. So one could think about this as sort of being inhabited by his ghost. But there he is, and she is really caught between holding on and letting go of the object of her loss. And she's really torn. And one of the things that happens in this clip is that the night before, she was with her best friend who gave birth to a new baby. And so she held the baby, she held new life, and a part of her is really drawn toward life and living again. But another part is deeply, deeply, deeply ambivalent and doesn't want to let go of the object of her loss. So let me try to do this.
Friend just had a baby. You're up half the night. It's traumatic. It's an emotional experience. Let's not turn that into...
Tell me about the first night we spent together.
She's hyper-cathecting memories.
Seriously? You want me to?
What did we do?
We talked.
What else?
Well, talking was the major component. You played that piano. Then I played. Then we both played something. Duet. Something. Can't remember. And then you danced for about 3 hours until I fell asleep. But you were fantastic. And then we had some cornflakes. And when we kissed, which was at about 11 o'clock the following morning, we were trembling so much we couldn't take off our clothes.
You see, I held that baby. So, it's a life I want. And all my taste, all my things. After you died, I found stuff in my trunk that I'd put there because you disapproved or laughed at them, you know, books and photographs and things. And I didn't know how to mend a fuse or find a plumber or bleed a radiator, but now I do. And it is a ridiculous flat, I know, but I think I'll get there. It will be beautiful. Could be, I think. And I so much longed for you. I longed for you.
Yeah. terms of your Spanish.
What?
There's a poem I wanted you to translate. I read it. There's a bit that I wanted to tell you, and I wanted you to hear.
Okay.
Perdóname.
Forgive me.
Si tú no vives.
I know this poem. If you are not living.
Si tú, querida, amor mío, si tú te has muerto.
If you, beloved, my love, if you have died.
Todas las noches caerán en mi pecho.
All the leaves will fall on my breast.
Lloverá sobre mi alma, noche y día.
It will rain on my soul all night, all day.
Mis pies querrán marchar hacia donde tú duermes.
My feet will want to march to where you are sleeping. Your accent's terrible.
Pero seguiré vivo.
My feet will want to march to where you are sleeping, but I shall go on living.
Do you want me to go?
No, never, 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 never.
So my feet will want to march to where you're going, but I will go on living. And that is the dilemma in grief, is that we do want to march to where the dead are going, but we must go on living. And again, it is, as Freud reminded us, a very difficult thing to begin to let go. Joan Didion writes again, "There's difference between grief as we imagine it and grief as it is. The unending absence that follows, the void, the very opposite of meaning, the relentless succession of moments during which we will confront the experience of meaninglessness itself. Grief is different. Grief has no distance. Grief comes in waves, in paroxysms, sudden apprehensions that weaken the knees and blind the eyes and obliterate the dailiness of everyday life." Freud, however, thought that with the passage of time and with an increasing capacity for reality, whatever that may be, the mourner slowly does begin to decathect, as we see in the film, the energy from the person who has died. And he thought that this frees up new energy, which can be reinvested in the living and in the world. So if one were to take Freud literally, he would posit that ultimately we do divest the intense energy that was directed towards the person who died in order to be able to love again. But Freud provides us another explanation for how we accomplish this task, and it's one of the first object relations concepts to really enter into psychoanalytic discourse. And Freud describes a process in which the shadow of the object falls upon the ego. And by this he meant that those of us who are survivors are always shaped by the person who has died, and that the shadow of that person comes to inhabit a part of our own self. In The Ego and the Id, then, Freud wrote about the important function of identification, in which aspects of the person who has died come to reside unconsciously in us. So it is the capacity to take in, to identify with, and to internalize aspects of those we have loved as parts of ourselves that ultimately make mourning bearable and even transformative. Again, we take in aspects of the person who has died, and that is a way in which our psychic growth takes place. So let me give an example. April, age 38, came to see me after her brother's suicide. The father of two boys, he had become profoundly depressed and had hung himself, knowing that his father would find him. My client had just moved to Northampton from the South and had taken a job as a nursing administrator. She wept a great deal. She brought in photos of her brother and her family and his family on her computer. She started a blog about his life, and she told his story to every new colleague who she met. After about 6 months, she was suddenly interested in focusing on her own four children, and the nature of our conversations changed. Quote, she said, "I want to be among the living, and I can because I really feel he's inside of me." In many ways, then, she had hypercathected his memories, including his investment in his work and his family, and she began to feel a renewed energy for her own. So for April, taking in the lost object was a positive thing. But what if the relationship is more problematic? Freud indicated that mourning and melancholia feel alike. Both the mourner and the melancholic feel dejected. They both experience a loss of interest in the outside world. They both feel preoccupied with the loss. And whether one is mourning or whether one is engaged in complicated grief and bereavement, one doesn't feel that one will ever be able to love again. But whereas the mourner feels these things intensely, the melancholic feels something else in addition, and that is a disturbance in self-regard, a disturbance in self-worth. So the difference, Freud thought, between mourning and melancholia is that the melancholic starts to feel really bad about him or herself. The melancholic suffers from what will later be called complicated or pathological grief. He or she feels self-critical, worthless, often with appetite or sleep disturbances. She or he may loathe herself or himself. And Freud thought that the complaints about the self were actually unconscious complaints about the person who had died. In other words, Freud posited that we feel a lot of aggression towards the people who die, and often that aggression is out of consciousness, and sometimes it's turned against the self in the form of self-hate. So Jane offers a picture of complicated grieving from a very classical psychoanalytic perspective. Jane was 75, devoutly Catholic, came to me because she was very depressed, having lost her husband of 40 years, 8 years before. Jane visited his grave daily. She prayed with him in the church. She went to Mass in the morning, in the afternoon, and in the evening. And none of that would be the least bit problematic, except for the degree to which she referred to her home as a tomb, was unable to cook or shop for herself, make or maintain any relationships, or find any meaning in her life. She had driven her three children away with a litany of complaints about them and about herself. So, Jane had married at 40. She had been the only child of seven siblings to live with her parents until she married. She had cared for her parents in spite of the physical abuse she had received from both parents. She also took care of all of her siblings' children. She cleaned their homes, she did their laundry at the expense of going to school herself, but she denied ever having any anger over foregoing college, and in fact, through clenched teeth, she used to tell me that she was never angry. So Jane had married a childhood friend who she had known on some level was gay. After conceiving three children, he moved into the extra bedroom and took a male lover 20 years his junior. Jane felt that her kids blamed her for the disaffection in the marriage, and she did not remember, though each of the adult children came in separately to tell me that she experienced murderous rage during their childhoods and that she would hit them with brushes, shoes, or with her hands. Again, a devout Catholic, Jean saw herself and her God as all good and all loving, and her husband as nothing less than a saint. She maintained this view despite his having told her on his deathbed that he had never loved her and he wished it were she who were dying and not he. So why had Jane become so depressed and even suicidal? Freud would surmise that Jane had great difficulty acknowledging her anger towards her husband, and that this anger was so great that it threatened to obliterate her memory of him. Secondly, Freud would maintain that she had a lot of anger that was not conscious towards him, that had been set up and directed against herself. And the third and perhaps most difficult problem for Jane, from a dynamic perspective, was her need to maintain in fantasy what had never really existed in reality. Freud wrote, quote, "One feels justified in maintaining that a loss has occurred, but one cannot see clearly what it is that has been lost. The patient cannot consciously perceive what he has lost either. What gives rise to melancholia is the sense that he knows whom he has lost, but not what has been lost in him." So from Freud's point of view, pathological mourning just doesn't end. It's debilitating, really debilitating, to internalize an unresolved and very conflicted relationship. And again, melancholia is so difficult to treat because of its often denied and unconscious roots. Let me give another example. John, a 31-year-old computer programmer, that must be rain. Good. Came to see me because he was engaged to be married to a woman with two children who was threatening to end the relationship because he wasn't at all present in the relationship. He, in fact, did not feel present with his fiancée or her children because he said he simply couldn't stop ruminating about the death of his father who had died 2 years before. He said he felt like an automaton, he felt dead inside, he felt like a robot, he was unable to experience any pleasure. And when he met with me, he kept repeating, "I should have done more, I should have done more." He told me how important his father had been to him. His father had taught him everything he knew about computers, but at the same time, he described a family in which he felt his two brothers could do no wrong and he himself could do no right. Both brothers had excelled in school and in sports, and John felt that neither parent had done very much to help him. They neither encouraged him by going to his sports events, they didn't give him rides, instruction, care, or didn't show a lot of concern. He had done very poorly in school, he felt misunderstood, and he probably had an undiagnosed learning disability. But now his father had died, and he idealized him. He was wonderful, he said, a wonderful computer technician, a wonderful man, a great father. But his complaints about his father never having been present for him had now become manifest in his lack of presence with his fiancée. So John, too, was stuck, unable to consciously acknowledge both his love and his anger for his father, and this left really no energy for new relationships. So what did Jane and John have in common? Both suffered from unconscious anger directed at a lost object, which was either repressed or disavowed. Now these very same feelings had become complaints about the self, resulting in lowered self-esteem and diminished self-love. Freud also wrote that the suffering of the melancholic might serve to punish the person who has died, and that in fact this might be at the heart of suicide. Dan, for example, was a financial analyst who at 50 was married with three daughters. He had been extremely successful at work. He was a civic leader and a person who had suffered his sister's suicide when he was in his 20s. His sister had hung herself when she had done poorly academically in law school. And Dan was adamant about having a third child so that none of his children would feel as abandoned as he had were something to happen to any one of them. His marriage, however, had begun to unravel, in part because of his own issues, and in part because of those of his wife. Neither was terribly capable of intimacy, and when Dan's wife left him for a woman, he became depressed and suicidal. His parents came to stay with him, and he hung himself, just as his sister had, so that it was his mother who found him as she had found her daughter. Freud might have said that Dan harbored murderous impulses towards his sister, which were reactivated by the abandonment of his wife. Her leaving opened a wound, and his suicide had a sadistic element to it. It punished his wife, it punished his parents, and it even punished his children. As my client, whose brother killed himself, said, he not only committed suicide, he took his life, but he also took ours. So let me just review what I've said so far. First, that when we have a loss, we slowly decathect our energy from the person who has died, from the world, and invest our energy into the person who has died. And we hypercathect that person's memories. But in order to be able to live again and to love again, we begin slowly to decathect from the lost object and begin to reinvest in the world. But for the melancholic, whose relationship to the person who has died has been ambivalent, or who harbors unconscious aggression, the loss may either be expressed in idealization, or in sadism, or in the loss of self-esteem. Now, it needs to be said that Freud revised his position on mourning many times, and actually, after the death of his own daughter, Sophie, and at the end of his career as a bereaved parent himself, he recognized that no one ever fully decathects from a loss. And he wrote, although we know that after such a loss, the acute stage of mourning will subside, we also know that we shall always remain inconsolable. We will never find a substitute, no matter what may fill the gap. And actually, this is as it should be. It's the only way of perpetuating the love that we don't want to relinquish. So in this statement of Freud's in 1917, we find the foreshadowing of another idea, that in mourning, we never fully give up the person we have lost. We always maintain a continuing relationship, and that our energy is never fully extinguished in terms of the people who have died. But one more important point of Freud's that bears repeating is this idea about identification, that we do take in aspects of the person who has died as part of ourselves, and that is what makes mourning livable and bearable. Okay, are you still with me? Yeah? Okay. So Hans Lowald gives another view of loss and mourning. And he writes not only about the ways in which losses change our sense of self, but also have the potential to change our ideals and our commitments. So Lowald is interested in how grief and loss actually is often the occasion not only for mourning, but for psychic growth. He says that for some, a loss may lead to a sense of mastery, and a loss may be transformative. At first, he says, separation and loss are always experienced as deprivations, but that loss may actually be freeing based on the degree to which we can fully identify with the person who has died. So Lowald is not emphasizing the negative aspects of grief and bereavement, and instead, he's seeing the way in which we take in the values and the ideals of the person who has died, which actually alters who we are and who we want to be. And he says the identifications that we make with people we have lost builds psychic structure. So again, when there is someone who we lose, who we've loved, we do gradually relinquish the tie, but by identifying with the values, the ideals, and the conscience of that person, we actually might change our own conscience, our own values, our own ideals. So from Lowald's point of view, mourning offers us the opportunity to change not only who we are ourselves, but who we want to become. So mourning offers the opportunity to change our ego ideals and again, even our conscience. I'm going to show a second clip. I just want to watch the time. Amy Beale was 22, living in South Africa. She was murdered while she was on a Fulbright there. She was working with a group of people to end apartheid. And so I want to show a clip of her parents who returned to South Africa for the Truth and Reconciliation Act and who carry on her ideals. So let me show this clip.
Because Amy was killed in South Africa, because our lives have now become forever linked to South Africa, we are here to share a little of Amy with you. Amy was a bright, active child. She loved competitive sports, such as swimming, diving, gymnastics, among others. Upon high school graduation, she went on to Stanford University. Her love of Nelson Mandela, as a symbol of what was happening in South Africa, grew.
Just 2 months before she died, Amy wrote in a letter to the Cape Times editor, "Racism in South Africa has been a painful experience for blacks and whites, and reconciliation may be equally painful. However, the most important vehicle toward reconciliation is open and honest dialogue."
Why in the mind do two say because Tinala believe what in open arms are liable? Baninimba umdana again, Ushiwa umdana, Yabo umtanda, Yabo Ipsungland, Yabo Sislona isn't a pili, Yabo. Two wound is booze, booze you want. Okay, and the guy asked, and I always under two some Yabo.
Amy would have embraced your truth and reconciliation process. We are present this morning to honor it and to offer our sincere friendship. We are all here, in a sense, to consider a committed human life, which was taken without opportunity for dialogue. When this process is concluded, we must link arms and move forward together.
Okay, so the Beals offer us just one example of how their own forgiveness changed their sense of themselves and also carried on their daughter's philosophy of life in ways that they might not have done otherwise. There are a million examples. In fact, almost every day when I read the newspaper, there is another example of someone who is changed by a loss and who undertakes an act that keeps the person who has died ideals alive. Consider, for example, two mothers, one black, one white, both of whose children were randomly murdered in Boston, one in the city, one in the suburbs. Coming together, these two women developed a response team for other mothers who lost their children violently. Soon thereafter, they found themselves advocating for gun legislation. They co-wrote a curriculum in the schools that was designed to lower violence. They then took to the road to tell their stories, not only in the legislature and in the classrooms, but in public meetings, including one on grief and bereavement that I attended. We're all familiar with the 9/11 families, ordinary people, lost spouses or siblings or parents or children. We've all seen how these very ordinary people have testified in Congress about lax security. They've fought for memorials that appropriately honor their dead, or they've spoken out against the war on terrorism and its failures. They have become just slightly extraordinary in their grief. Or we can think about the Rosenberg children, two boys, ages 2 and 6, when their parents, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, were alleged to be spies and put to death in the 1950s. These boys were visibly present during their parents' trials and pending executions, and then were ultimately adopted and out of the public eye. But in midlife, both boys, both men, began to speak out about their parents' unjust trials and executions, and they began a charitable foundation called Save the Children, which now serves to protect the rights of other children whose parents have been victims of political persecution. Or we can take the example of Susan Komen's sister, a runner who started the Susan Komen Foundation, which runs, as I'm sure you know, marathons as fundraisers and has now become an organization that has raised over $10 million to fight breast cancer. So what's going on here? Might some of these personal and political activities reflect the ideals of the dead as embodied in the living? It seems to me that each of these mourners have engaged in processes that not only alter their senses of self, but also that alter their values and ideals and carry on the values and ideals of those who have died. One other example was offered in my doctoral class last semester. An Afro-Caribbean social worker had worked with a client in a Caribbean island who had been homeless and dying of HIV/AIDS. This client was stigmatized. She was shunned by friends, by family. But my student made sure that there was going to be a proper burial, a proper memorial service for her client, and also for those who died after her. My student talked in class about how her own values, her own ideals, were shaped by this death, and also that she continues to visit the unmarked stone when she returns to the island. I would maintain that even more is going on here, because I think that not only has the mourner identified with the values and ideals of the person who has died, but also the mourner has moved from a position of passivity and helplessness to one of activity and mastery. Might grief and mourning then offer means of coping with overwhelming losses through the personal becoming political? From a constructivist point of view, this occurs through what Robert Niemeyer called meaning reconstruction. Here, the mourner is not a passive recipient of a terrible thing happening to him or her, but in fact is the maker of new meaning. What Niemeyer holds is that what moves us from unbearable grief to something social and contributory is the meaning that we make of the event. Bereavement, then, can always occasion new meanings out of events that have occurred and lead the mourner to try to make changes in the social world, in the emotional world, in the cultural context in which he or she lives. Probably some of you know the work of Gerald Kaplan, who understood the transformative nature of a crisis and who reminded us that crises often result in a changed sense of self, a changed sense of relationships, and a changed philosophy of life. So too does surviving a loss often lead to a changed sense in self and to existential and spiritual growth. I was going to give an example from my own life. I think I'll make it really brief. I was 40 years old. I was preparing a class one summer at the School for Social Work, and my sister, who was then 42, called. I was chattering on about how I wanted to have a second child, and she was very silent, and her silence was quite ominous, and I actually stopped talking for a minute and asked her what was going on, and she told me she had breast cancer. She had breast cancer. She was going to have a mastectomy, and she was having a very difficult time. I then had to force myself to imagine what it was like for her. She was a social worker. She was in a bad marriage. She had three young children, and things were very difficult. 5 years passed, the breast cancer seemed to be cured, or at least in remission, and She then came up to Northampton for a month with her kids, and she had a very bad cough that wouldn't remit, and so she tried acupuncture. It didn't help. We ended up seeing my internist. He hospitalized her and gave her a diagnosis of myelodysplastic syndrome and gave her 2 years or less to live. So we did all the things that people do when you get a terrible diagnosis. We went to a major city. We saw all the kinds of medical people one sees. Ultimately, she was hospitalized, and that was because her platelet levels were hovering around 4,000, which is very, very bad. She was told she needed a bone marrow transplant and that she had better have it fast. She did not actually want a bone marrow transplant. She was really ambivalent about this highly touted cure. She wasn't sure that she wanted to be brought to the brink of death and then back again. But when she expressed her ambivalence to the bone marrow transplant chief, his response was quick and imperious. He told her to leave, us to leave. He had lots of people who wanted his cure and that we were wasting his time. What became clear was nobody knew my sister's history, our history, that we had had a father who was ill and dying at the same age my sister was. We had been three children. We were exactly the same ages as my sister's children. But there was no social worker to elicit a psychosocial history. At any rate, my sister decided to undergo the transplant. She went in with a number of concerns. She didn't want to be cognitively impaired. She didn't want to experience the crippling anxiety that she was experiencing. But there was no social worker to call a psychopharm consult. There was no social worker to help her with an advance directive. There was no social worker to call a family conference. There was no social worker to address her concrete needs or her depression. Actually, after she died, it would have been useful to have had a social worker address the team. They came in to say that the patient failed. It would have been really nice to have had a social worker who could have interpreted to the team that, in fact, it wasn't the patient who failed. It was the procedure. So on many levels, individual, group, family, systemic, it would have been really useful to have a social worker, but my sister was a social worker, and having one would mean looking mortality in the eye. And so my sister and I, two social workers, two children who had had a parent die in adolescence, became complicit in shielding her children from the reality of her illness and what became her death. She spent 5 months in a bone marrow transplant unit in isolation. Everyone who visited her was gowned and gloved. My sister never left the room except for three trips to the ICU. And then she had a second bone marrow transplant. And after that, it was time for the team to come. It had not worked. And to say that she was actually going to go home. They presented this as good news. There was no care team in place. There was no way in which she could go home, and so she kindly had a stroke, which solved the problem of having to go home, but which left her cognitively impaired and physically immobilized. At any rate, I was coming back from a meeting of doctoral directors, and a woman got on the plane, the last seat on the plane from California, and she whipped out the bone marrow donor register. And I thought, I don't usually talk to people on six-hour flights, but I did have to ask her why she was reading that. And it turned out she had come from the first meeting of psychosocial needs of bone marrow transplant patients and families. And so I began to tell her my story. It took 6 hours to tell that story. But by the time I finished it, I had begun to weave a narrative about my sister's life. 2 years later, there was a call for social work leaders on the project in Death in America. I felt like I knew nothing about death except my lived experience. But I applied for it anyway because I thought, I have to do something about the state of the absence of social work in bone marrow transplantation. And so I started an end-of-life certificate program, wrote a book, and we've trained a lot of social workers. But the point of all this is that I think that my activities, like those I've mentioned, represent the shadows of the dead embodied by the living. I think I was engaging in processes that I was unaware of that were changing myself, changing my identity, but also that changed my values and my ideals. I was creating new meaning out of my own loss experience. And again, this was not particularly unusual, but like so many, I found that the experience led to a new understanding and a new way of being. I also like to use this example because it offers me the opportunity to stay in a continued relationship with my sister. So more recently, and from a constructivist perspective, we know that we don't ever relinquish the ties to the person who has died, but we engage in, as I do, in interpersonal relationships that are ongoing with the deceased. And in that process, we change, and actually they change. I have routine conversations with my sister. I talk to her about dilemmas with her kids. I get mad at her. I tell her what I'm doing with them. And in this way, she changes and I change. So these conversations are what Phyllis Silverman calls continuing bonds. In this view, we all maintain, as I say, continuing relationships with those who have died, keeping their passions alive, taking on aspects of them, holding on to their ideals, communicating with them as a way to problem solve. In short, we maintain both internal relationships with people who have died and interpersonal relationships with people who have died. And this brings us comfort, solace, and relief. In healthy mourning, this gives us access to our memories, and it offers the opportunity to create new kinds of relationships with the dead. Again, in the process, our own images of ourselves change, and our images of the other change. When someone dies, we are never the same that we were before the loss. So Freud is right. Loss and grief do empty us out for a time. But mourning also has the potential to heal. Losses may be lasting gifts. They may leave legacies in the forms of acts of altruism, as we saw with the Beals. They may lead to creative changes in ourselves and our identity. Out of profound distress, new narratives, new meaning may be created, which offer us mastery over what couldn't be mastered before. Again, out of what feels like unbearable distress, new meaning may be created. Whether one begins a group that advocates against gun violence, whether one creates a memorial with others, whether one forgives the murderers of one's child, these are ways of transforming our pain into action, of taking charge, and of creating a new story and a new self. Again, we don't consciously sit down and ask ourselves, what lessons did I learn? But unconsciously, we carry out the values and the ideals of the person who has died, healing ourselves while often helping others to heal. There is, in mourning, a need for coherence, a need for meaning, and so, again, bereavement narratives become legacies, and they become memorials. And again, many losses result in renewed commitments to that which is greater than ourselves. So let me just say a word about some of the clinical implications, and I will stop. I think that some of the best work that goes on in bereavement goes on in groups, and often in self-help groups that are not led by professionals, where grief can be less stigmatized, less isolating, and in groups, there is the opportunity to, again, help others as one is mastering one's own loss. Likewise, in groups, people are in similar circumstances, and so they can tell their stories again and again and again and mobilize one another to take some action. Groups offer the opportunity to create a narrative, to engage in ritual, and to, again, gain a sense of meaning. Loss groups offer a way to continue relationships with those who have died while also connecting to others who have suffered similarly. Another form of helping the bereaved may occur through symbolic forms of disruption and repair. I gave a talk a couple of years ago at Bo's Place in Houston, Texas, which was a child and family bereavement center started by two parents who had lost their child to leukemia. And I was struck by a family project that everyone engaged in as they left the program and terminated. Every grieving family was given the shards of a pot, and the family's job was to put the pot back together. But in fact, pieces of the pot were missing, and there was no way to bring it back to its original wholeness. So inevitably, in the process of trying to reconstruct the pot, the family had to come to terms with the holes, the imperfections, the parts that would always be missing and absent. But in the course of trying to put back that which had been shattered, the families did their best to come to terms with the fact that there are some things that can never be fully repaired. Likewise, another important clinical tool in camps for children, camps for adults, may be memory books. And again, often in AIDS camps, cancer camps, children or adults may construct these memory books, which will have photos of the person who is ill or the person who has died, the person's favorite sayings, the mourner's favorite experiences with the parent or with the person who has died. And these books tend to come out every summer. People come back and back and back to these camps. And there is something very healing in being able to tell the stories again and put the new photographs in the book. Some children benefit from stuffing the shirt of a parent who has died, thus creating literally arms that can hold the child with the texture and smell of the parent who has died. We know that for adolescents, there is great value in telling the stories of the dead with other adolescents. And often some of the best ways to do that is through writing and sometimes through collages. It's also very important, and especially in adolescent groups, to help those who are grieving understand that they will always have a relationship with the person who has died, and again, that that relationship will change as they do. So let me end by saying grief always changes the mourner. It can undo us, it can result in guilt, in self-hate, in blame, or it can positively transform us, our sense of self, our identity, our ideals. The boys who lost their parents to political persecution and became champions of children whose parents were also victims of political persecution, the parents who forgave the killers of their children, the mothers who worked against gun violence, the sister who started the Susan Komen Foundation, all demonstrate some of the ways in which grief changes the mourner. But it's really important to say that not everybody becomes an advocate, an activist, nor should they. And yet, grief does seem to promote some psychological growth. It may heighten our appreciation for living. It may change who we are, how we see ourselves. Anne Morrow Lindbergh wrote, "I do not believe that sheer suffering teaches. If suffering alone taught, then all the world would be wise, since everyone suffers. To suffering must be added mourning, understanding, patience, love, openness, and the willingness to remain vulnerable." So I was musing on all this a couple of years ago, sitting in the shul during the high holidays, and every year there's a recitation that captures these ideas without psychoanalytic theory so simply, and it's entitled, "We Remember Them." So just listen for the identifications, the internalizations, the way in which loss changes the self and the ideals of the person who survives. The poem is this. "At the rising of the sun and at its going down, we remember them. At the blowing of the wind and in the chill of winter, we remember them. At the opening of the buds and in the rebirth of spring, we remember them. At the shining of the sun and the warmth of summer, we remember them. At the rustling of the leaves and in the beauty of autumn, we remember them. At the beginning of the year and at its end, we remember them." And this is the part. "As long as we live, they too will live, for they are now a part of us as we remember them. When we are weary and in need of strength, we remember them. When we are lost and sick at heart, we remember them. When we have joy we crave to share, we remember them. When we have decisions that are difficult to make, we remember them. When we have achievements based on theirs, we remember them. As long as we live, they too will live, for they are now a part of us as we remember them.